This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black Agenda Radio this week examines two questions that confront those who want to bring down the 500-year reign of Euro-American colonialism and imperialism. How do people free themselves from the oppressor's rule without becoming like the colonial master? And how can the nations of what used to be called the Third World create economies of prosperity while still respecting the environment and the rights of indigenous peoples? But first, some news from Central Africa. Bobby Wine, a wildly popular musician and member of the Ugandan parliament, was arrested and severely beaten by police, along with several other elected officials. The police shot Bobby Wine's driver dead. Wine and his colleagues are vehemently opposed to the 32-year rule of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, one of Washington's closest military allies on the African continent. We spoke with Milton Alamadi, publisher of Black Star News in New York City and a native of Uganda. We asked Alamadi what the arrest and brutalization of Bobby Wine says about the Museveni regime.
What it says that he's pretty worried, actually. He's stolen the last four elections in Uganda. Basically, he runs, he loses, but he's in control of the military and the police. And he appoints the election commission himself. So they declare him the victor. So when he lost in 2016 to the main challenger, Dr. Kizza Besigye, he just ignored the results of the election. And the election commission declared him the winner. So that's why he's still running the country. But in Bobby Wine, this courageous, brave musician, wildly successful, making a good living with his music, but also represents the youth and the frustration of the youth in Uganda. He's 36 years old. Unemployment, youth unemployment in Uganda is estimated at 85%, which means there's just a boiling resentment of youth waiting to explode at any given moment. He ran for parliament last year, and he defeated the candidate of the ruling party, Museveni's National Resistance Movement Party, that's been in power for 32 years now. He won 80% of the vote. So obviously that caught Museveni's attention. And he's been worried of this young man ever since. He fears that it will be difficult for him to steal another election because they may go out to the streets and say, no, we know you did not win. He's much more worried than Bobby Wine's followers, than the followers of Kizza Besigye, who's also actually beat him a number of times in past elections.
And there has been a response from Bobby Wine's followers in the streets.
Yes, there has been a response. They've been out in the streets demonstrating already, and the regime came out viciously. Even journalists were being beaten. But it's being widely covered now for the first time relative to past uprisings in Uganda, to the extent that even the military have to come out and apologize, not for assaulting the Ugandan civilians, but for assaulting members of the press, because I think the journalist who was beaten also works for Reuters. So they care much more about international attention than what they do in terms of brutalizing Ugandans. So Bobby Wine was beaten viciously and arrested, as you pointed out, August 13. He had gone to campaign on behalf of a candidate in a by-election for parliament, a candidate named Cassiano Wadri, who was also arrested and beaten, together with Gerald Kabuhanga, Paul Mwiru, both members of parliament, Francis Zake, and a former member of parliament, Michael Mabike. But even though they were all in detention, being beaten and tortured, Cassiano Wadri won even while he was in prison, which was another repudiation of Museveni. And that's why he's very worried about this young individual, Robert Kyagulanyi, a.k.a. Bobi Wine. In the past three by-elections for parliament, each of the candidates endorsed by Bobi Wine has won. So Museveni's fear is very real, very legitimate. And the more he brutalizes these individuals, particularly Bobi Wine, the more resentment builds up against his regime. The global outcry, as you know, protests, prominent musicians have signed on to letters demanding his release. Wole Soyinka was one of the individuals that signed on to this letter as well. So there's a global campaign. Ugandans have been protesting wherever they reside, all over the world, including here in the U.S., in Boston, in Washington. And today we're meeting to plan one, a protest here in New York City.
And we've seen videos of Bobi Wine as he attempted to appear in court, and he looks to be very seriously injured.
Yes, he does. He could barely walk. He was actually supported, as you may have seen from the images, by three or four people to be able to walk, to come to face the judge. And he also had a crutch on his right arm to support his right side. He was actually not able to speak last week when he first made his first court appearance. He seems to be able to at least move his mouth now, you know, when he was brought in yesterday. And the purpose of yesterday's appearance was that he's now been transferred because he had been charged in a military courts martial. But after the universal global condemnation, he's now been transferred to a civilian court. In the military courts martial, he faced illegal weapons possession, which the owner of the hotel where he was staying in the city of Arua, where he was arrested, said is nonsense because they inspect every guest carefully. They're well aware of the consequences of any guest coming into the hotel with weapons. So the manager of the hotel and the owner said, no, there were no weapons. Any weapons must have been planted subsequently on his person by the state to concoct these charges. Now, in the civilian court trial, he's now been charged with treason, which is the same kind of charges that the other members of the parliament were also facing. So now they're all in the same court, civilian court, in the city of Gulu in the northern part of Uganda.
And what is the alleged basis of this treason charge?
Thank you for asking that question. How did it emanate in the first place? Why was his personal driver shot and killed? And he believes they actually thought it was him sitting in the car. On the day of the campaign, on the 13th of August, when he was out there campaigning for candidate Kassiano Wadri, together with all the other supporters, Museveni's folks allege that these individuals incited their supporters to start hurling stones at the presidential motorcade, and that, in fact, one of the vehicles, the rear windshield, was shattered, and they produced a photograph of that vehicle. And people wondered, how could a bulletproof vehicle have its window shattered? And then they came out with another photograph and said the outer layer is not bulletproof. The inner window is the one that was bulletproof. And then people said, where were the glasses then? Why were there no glass particles of the vehicle whose window was shattered? So it's utter complete nonsense, number one. Number two, even if that were true, that people that may be totally frustrated with the 32 years of the U.S.-supported tyrant and indeed had thrown stones at his motorcade, how do you then pin that on Bobi Wine, who was nowhere near the scene? How do you pin it on his driver, who was nowhere on the scene? So on that basis, alleging that they incited people to attempt to take Museveni's life by throwing stones at the presidential motorcade, on that basis is the basis of the charges of treason, which in Uganda carries a death penalty.
Well, certainly this episode further detracts from the legitimacy of Museveni's rule with Ugandans. But what does it mean for his main relationship, the one he's had since Ronald Reagan was president of the United States?
It's becoming embarrassing. It's becoming embarrassing because they find it very difficult now to pretend that this is not a very destructive dictator that we have with U.S. taxpayers' dollars to the extent of more than $1 billion annually with U.S. arms and U.S. military training, which of course is unlawful because the Leahy Amendment, which is actually still on the books, prohibits the United States State Department as well as the Department of Defense for military cooperation with any country whose military units are engaged in human rights abuse. And Uganda has qualified for a very long time to be barred from any military cooperation with the U.S. under the Leahy Amendment. So the more coverage that these kind of incidents now get, it makes it much more difficult for this hypocritical government of the United States to pretend that it's actually working with an individual who is not that bad. That is the positive side of the major coverage that's coming out, and it will galvanize more people to keep resisting Museveni on the ground and outside the country. It helps us certainly to mobilize against the U.S. administration in continuing to support this dictator in Uganda. And it gives hope to people back home as well that the diaspora is fully engaged in the struggle as well.
Museveni is also deeply complicit in the death of 6 million Congolese.
Absolutely. As we know, had it not been for the Ugandan invasion of the Congo in 1997 and multiple invasions subsequently, 6 million or more Congolese would not have perished the way they did. Uganda has invaded multiple times. It even occupied Eastern Congo for several years from 1998 to 2005 until it was found liable by the International Court of Justice, and the Congo was awarded reparations ranging from $6 to $10 billion. Only then did Uganda withdraw its regular army, and since then it's been supporting militias that still go in and out of the Congo to cause havoc and destruction. And this is another interesting point that I wanted to bring up. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal from June 8, 2006. And that article says, based on the finding of the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court then wanted to launch its own investigation. And this was a deserved investigation, in fact, of Uganda's alleged crimes in the Congo. And that Museveni contacted then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan personally and asked him to block this criminal investigation. And according to the article, Kofi Annan said he did not have the powers to block that investigation. But certainly somebody with the powers blocked that investigation, because Museveni should be on the record as having been indicted by the ICC. If the ICC could indict Mohamed al-Bashir of the Sudan, of the alleged atrocities in Darfur, nothing compares to the atrocities committed in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the 6 million dead. And yet Museveni has never been indicted. It means to me, going by that account in that article, that somebody intervened, and it can only be the usual suspects, the United States.
And in fact, Uganda was convicted in the World Court for what the World Court said seemed to be genocidal activities in Congo. And yet, Museveni has refused to pay.
Absolutely. And you know, what makes it even much more saddening is that the same kind of crimes that were being committed in Eastern Congo mirrors the crimes that were committed in the northern part of Uganda, which is brilliantly told in the documentary film, A Brilliant Genocide. And people can also search and Google that
or go on YouTube. I think there are several clips from that film. Burning people's homes with people inside, digging pits and burying people alive, and then setting fire on top of it with grass, and then raping, mass rape of both men and women. That is a pattern that even in the many decades, the 37 years that Mobutu was the dictator of the Congo and committed crimes against his people, those kind of crimes were never committed in the Congo. The mass rapes of both men and women. That was first seen in the northern part of Uganda, and then Museveni and his army transported those types of crimes into the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
And inside Uganda, you mentioned an 85% youth unemployment rate. That is not a number that is indicative of a successfully developing country.
Absolutely not. And that is the ultimate tragedy, really, in that the more this regime is prolonged and stays in place, the more the destruction, the more economic retrogression that is occurring. How do you justify even being in government if almost 9 out of 10 of the youth are unemployed? And the youth actually translates into the population because they are the vast majority, almost 80% of the population is characterized as the youth. So rather than saying youth unemployment, I should actually amend it and say unemployment is at 85%. This to me is the worst form of indictment. And it really questions, it really, because you know, the saddest part of it, it almost repudiates everything that Kwame Nkrumah's generation had fought for African independence, to really transform African societies and African nations. Yet, it's not surprising that Museveni is the type of reliable so-called ally that the United States would like to have in Africa, because he represents the type of misrule that Mobutu imposed on the Congo. And of course, as you know, the U.S. was complicit in killing Patrice Lumumba, who had a vision for the Congo, and installed Mobutu and kept him in power for 37 years. And now they've kept Museveni in power for 32 years and counting. And the youth in Uganda are now resisting. And I believe the youth in Uganda will succeed. Because even as Bobby Wine himself said, he's not afraid of dying, because he knows that the youth will carry the march that Bobby Wine is now leading in Uganda.
That was Milton Alamadi, publisher of Black Star News, speaking from New York City. Europe and the United States became great industrial powers through centuries of theft of the labor and land of the colonized people of the planet. In the process, great harm has been inflicted on both the environment and the indigenous peoples of the formerly colonized world. Destruction that continues even in those developing countries with left-wing governments. Macarena Gomez-Barris is author of The Extraction Zone, Social Ecologies and Decolonial Perspectives. She's also chair of the Department of Social Sciences and Cultural Studies at Pratt Institute. Gomez-Barris warns that those activists who claim the Earth has no future are unwittingly allowing the rich to continue spreading their ideology of disposability.
I did refer to the idea that we're supposedly, as a species and human, non-human entities, moving towards total apocalypse, towards total catastrophe. And we get this message all the time from climatologists, from even amongst the politically left, the idea that humanity will end and we're at beyond the turning point. On the one hand, this is a really important idea because a lot of us have been able to rally around the idea that extractive and racial capitalism needs to abate, needs to subside, needs to end, and we can begin social movements and activities with each other that are anti-capitalist, since we have to name the culprit that is producing the possibility of our extinction. But of course, Black and brown communities, Black and brown histories show us that there have been long in place anthropogenic, human-led catastrophe in the making from 1492 forward. And if we mark that period of colonialism, we'll understand also that there have been lots of people who have fought against this, who have struggled against this, who have kept their worldview intact of other possibilities and other ways of being in the world that are not about destruction and accumulation of profit first. So my point there is really to say, let's look at those histories. Let's understand where we're at in the course of colonial history and colonial capitalism, and let's begin to think with each other beyond the idea that is inevitable for our planet to fully collapse. And to me, it's an ideology that allows for unchecked, very bad and corrupt behavior amongst those who would like to steal and continue to thieve upon Black and brown communities, bodies, territories, and continue with rapacious activities that actually will lead to the demise. But if we assume that that's a foregone conclusion, where is the critical hope? And that's the question I have.
And you find places of critical hope in Chile, in Peru, Bolivia, Eastern Ecuador, Southwest Colombia. Those are the places where your work has been centered.
Correct. And in the extractive zone, I really contend with South American spaces. I'm myself a Chilean exile. My family suffered the experience of the authoritarian dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet during the overthrow of Salvador Allende, which you probably know was the first socialist president ever elected on the planet. And there were very strong solidarities internationally with Salvador Allende's project. And we can look back and critique, you know, where certain populations were not necessarily as considered. He was on the way to thinking more about indigenous populations. There was a Black solidarity contingent. Angela Davis even visited Chile during that moment. So I really come out of a history of U.S. imperialism and authoritarianism. So for me, it was really important to concentrate on those histories coming out of my own genealogy. So when I did my work, I centered on South America, and I think a lot about a Southern perspective, not exclusively a Southern perspective in South America, but to think that Southern perspectives have long been marginal perspectives. If we go back to Gramsci in Southern Italy and how he was thinking about the South in relationship to Italian workers and marginality there, if we think about the U.S., the American South during segregation and long histories of the plantation system there. So I really try to think about perspective that includes Southern thinking. And for me, South America is certainly about that. And a lot of the spaces I study were indigenous spaces. And in Colombia, it also happens to be Afro-descended spaces. And from studying people and communities who have long been contending with Spanish, Canadian, U.S., their own national corporations coming in and basically extracting huge amounts of resources to the point now where we have mega dams and mega extractive industries. For me, it was really important to talk to people, to look at the social movements, to think, move with people, and understand the ways in which they're actually surviving and thriving under those extremely difficult conditions of duress. So that's where, for me, some of the critical hope lies. It's not the only place. Certainly communities of color in the United States have long similar histories of pushing back against carceral capitalism and imprisonment and enslavement, etc. But for me, that was really important to start with a deep, deep analysis that comes out of the spaces I know and I was born into.
Yes, we have seen clashes between national leadership with a socialist orientation and the indigenous people who are part of that country in terms of what are the modalities of development? What is development?
Such a great question. I mean, development is one of those words that has been used against submerged, what I call submerged perspectives, or the subaltern, or marginalized communities, however you want to put it. Development has been used as a way to suggest that there is a more basic level of human development, and through technology and modern progress and all the implements of capitalism, that actually humanity could move to a better state. And of course, we know this has a long history of imperial imposition in communities. And for me, the idea of development is actually a defunct one, one we need to kind of dispense with. It's so aligned with a kind of Western epistemology that does not allow for ideas of sustainability, ideas of cohabitation, relationality, modes of being that are more horizontal, alternatives to capitalism, ways of thinking about markets that don't necessarily run through the colonial machine. And so development in the context that I describe really it's an exterior or an external imposed idea that a lot of communities are dispensing with or turning to other ways of thinking or naming their realities of trying to think about futurity. Because really, if you think about development and what it's meant in the hands of corporations, it's basically to think about futurity and the future for the few and the 1%. And, you know, if we take the logic to its ultimate conclusion, exist for those who are able to survive in complete resource collapse. And development depends upon extracting more and more natural resources and converting them and circulating them within pharmacological circulations of capital, et cetera. So for me, it's really about trying to, in my study and thinking with the people that I know and have worked with, artists, scholars, activists, it's trying to pull back on the idea of development and think more critically about the now and the future.
In Bolivia, a person, a president of indigenous extraction, has been in office for some time with the electoral support of the indigenous majority of that country. How do you see futurity versus development in Bolivia?
Such a wonderful question. I mean, both in Ecuador and Bolivia, you know, in Bolivia first, we had a really strong sense that indigenous peoples would be put first. It was a really momentous moment when Evo Morales was elected. There was a sense of possibility that Bolivia could actually turn against the history of colonialism in that country. And I always use the example of a mountain called Cerro Rico in Potosí, Bolivia. And that mountain has been extracted of its minerals, silver, tin resources since 1512. And that mountain is on the point of collapse. And it's really representational of kind of the history of Bolivia in the sense that it was, of course, indigenous enslaved labor first under the Mita system, and then Afro-descendant labor second, that basically fueled the Industrial Revolution in Europe. And Potosí was one really important epicenter of that. And so it was quite momentous to have the long, long march towards Evo Morales's presidency. And initially, a lot of us and a lot of the kind of political, both the left in Latin America and politically left-minded people in the United States and in the world, look to Bolivia as the place for the new site of revolution. But of course, if you look at the history of Bolivia, there's been continuous uprising, continuous insurgency. It's not just this one moment of capture of the state, the pinnacle of power, but a continuous insurgency that has been so important to that history. And soon after, Evo Morales, a couple, you know, maybe a year or 2 years into his presidency, one could see the principles of the neoliberal global network in operation again. So under Morales, unfortunately, have been some of the largest extractive activities ever. Huge new sites of dams, huge new mining activities, mega mining activities, and have all opened up under Evo Morales. And this is something that a lot of even the on-the-ground social movements were ready to critique this pretty early on, but a lot of progressives, especially in the United States, did not want to hear this message that under the current neoliberal global system, it is very, very difficult to get outside of that, to find other solutions and to find other alternatives. But feminists were early to critique this and to say, well, certainly this new Morales system is working for some, but still women, sex workers, mothers have been left out of a lot of the social policies, and they were also pointing to the extractive activities. So my conclusion that I make in my new book, Beyond the Pink Tide, is really to suggest we're at a point, you know, we're at a point in the history of humanity, if you will, to look and beyond state-centered solutions. I'm not suggesting that we absolutely ignore the state. We need to completely critique, dismantle, push against, rework the state. But what other possibilities are out there? What other radical challenges are out there that could fuel a different understanding of what is possible? And the case of Bolivia and the case of Ecuador and the case of the pink tide governments or the so-called left-leaning governments that swept Latin America as an alternative to the Washington consensus during the 1990s and 2000s, that those examples, I think, are really important ones for us to look at and to see why maybe just changing the state is not going to resolve our problems.
Much of your work is centered in Colombia. That's a country that's suffered under 40 years of civil war, and some of the people who suffered most have been the indigenous folks and also Afro-Colombians who have been displaced by the millions. But the indigenous and the Afro-Colombians have grave problems not just with the government, but with the FARC guerrillas.
Yes, this is another great opportunity for us to think through the history of radical revolution and militant revolution and militant guerrilla activity in the Americas, and certainly the operations of the FARC and its imbrication and entanglement with all kinds of illicit activities and the drug economy of production and consumption that runs through the hemisphere and produced criminal activity and death for many, and certainly displaced and dispossessed, as you suggested, some of the largest refugee communities of Afro-descendant and indigenous peoples have come out of Colombia, and it continues to be a huge area of land grab by corporations. What is interesting in the work that I did in Cauca, Colombia, in southwestern Colombia, along the Magdalena River, which is also a really important ecological system because it runs the length not only of the nation, but runs through the Amazonian basin and, you know, the river itself runs from the Caribbean basin all the way through the length of the country and thus travels through many, many different kinds of ecological and environments, geographies, et cetera. And so it is a space of Black and Indigenous struggle. And what I learned from my work there is that corporations very much take advantage of not only dispossession and civil war and strife and the problems that come along with producing poverty, right? It's a production of poverty. Poverty doesn't just happen. It's produced by through dispossession of people who are in very resource-rich territories and then have nowhere to go and, you know, have to live in shantytowns and the state abandons them, et cetera, et cetera. So What I learned is that corporations learn from previous struggles. So the corporation that has been really toxic and very detrimental in Southwest Colombia is Endesa, a Spanish corporation of hydroelectricity that was also involved in southern Chile. In southern Chile, Mapuche, Pehuenche, Huilliche peoples, the indigenous people of southern Chile, were successful in an international campaign of struggle against Endesa to even expand their control over certain river basins in southern Chile. What Endesa did when it transferred and began its hydroelectric dams and implementation in Colombia is really to learn from that experience and to try to mount a campaign against indigenous and mestizo communities before they could even understand what was happening to them, with 22 new dams being constructed in their areas. And so they brought in the police, they brought in special armed forces. That military state that you referred to that was constructed during the 40-year Civil War period was then, the full force of that was brought upon these communities to suggest, you will be displaced, we will create these dams in your communities, and we will arrest you, we will kill you, we will disappear you if we hear otherwise. So the experience of Colombia has actually allowed me to rethink, and a lot of what's happened in the Americas has been not only the Cold War activity, not only an activity of U.S. imperialism against socialism of resources, but these have been extractive wars. They're currently extractive wars. They have been extractive wars for a longer period, and you can really see how that's in operation in a place like southwestern Colombia, that has become so militarized. There's so many places we could talk about the Americas. It's not the only one, but it's the one, you know, you chose to ask me about. So in this way, I think you can really see the full kind of operation of the military state at work there.
We hear you rejecting state solutions to the planetary crisis. And we also hear you speak in positive terms of socialists. Are you a socialist? And if so, what kind of socialist are you?
Yes, I am a socialist that thinks about community possibilities, the local, the close networks, the familial, beyond the normative familial, friendship, solidarities between different groups of people. I think we do have solutions. I think if we, much like Moten and Harney cite in the Undercommons, I feel that if we stop thinking about debt in terms of being indebted to a global system and instead think about our indebtedness to each other, that we will find each other more quickly and provide networks of affiliation that can manage our own sense of how we want to live in the world, and through trading, bartering, networks. I understand that I am both complicit in a capitalist system and contribute to it, but I am also knowledgeable and more firmly accepting than ever of the fact that as a tenured professor, I have opportunities to engage with my art students, to engage with colleagues, to engage with activists, to engage with community members, to use those platforms to really extend a different kind of way of being and thinking in the world that goes beyond capitalist logics of accumulation. So I was born in a socialist moment, and I'm sure that is deep in my psychology, but to me, it wasn't necessarily about the state-centered revolution that happened in Allende that was so powerful, but about all of the stories that I've heard from relatives, from friends, from family members of what it meant to live in a moment when you actually thought you could change the future and live in much more proximity to freedom. Freedom is a very important yet difficult goal to attain. So for me, it's about living as close as possible in proximity to freedom as one can. And that was an important moment. And so I certainly carry those hopeful critically hopeful notes with me and inside of me in the kind of work that I carry forward. So I hope that answers your question.
That was Professor Macarena Gomez-Barros, author of The Extraction Zone, Social Ecologies and Decolonial Perspectives. Her book was featured last week in the Black Agenda Book Forum. And so was a book by Dr. Julietta Singh titled Unthinking Mastery, Dehumanization and Decolonial Entanglements. Singh is an associate professor of English at the University of Richmond. She's deeply concerned that previously oppressed people not internalized the ideology and behavior of the oppressor. We asked Dr. Singh the question, how do people wage a liberation struggle against ruthless capitalists or imperial powers like the United States, including armed struggle, and not appear to be behaving like the oppressor, like the master?
That's an incredible question that I'm in no way equipped to answer, but I will say that one of the reasons why I was compelled to think the kinds of things that I was thinking in Unthinking Mastery is that I was looking at anti-colonial movements that were both pacifist and expressly violent and trying to think about the continuities among these movements instead of thinking about them as diametrically opposed. And so I can't speak to the question of how to wage a struggle, violent or otherwise, without appearing masterful. I can explain what it means to think about and act as a master. And so what I was trying to think about in the book is the way that in the last century, when we saw mass movements for decolonization around the globe, it was a moment when 85% of the Earth's surface was under colonial rule, and a moment when almost in a domino effect, nation states were fighting more and less aggressively for their independence against Western European colonizers. And what I was trying to think about is the ways that there's a kind of oversimplification in the way that we understand those movements historically. And two easy examples, and the ones that are most prominent in my book, are Mohandas Gandhi on the one hand in India, the famous passive resistance fighter, and France Fanon on the other, who is far too easily read as merely a kind of violent activist, somebody who believes that decolonization must happen through violence. And so what I was trying to do is think about the ways in which these movements that seem to be diametrically opposed are in fact critically linked through the question of mastery. And so what you see in decolonization movements in the last century is a series of movements happening in very different geopolitical regions across the world, expressly all decry the relationship between colonizers and the colonized as a relationship between masters and slaves. And so there's a fundamental understanding in decolonization movements that mastery is bad, that holding mastery over another population is a negative aspect that needs to be undone through decolonization. And one of the things that I noticed is that over and over again in these movements, no matter how radically disparate they appear, there was a recurring return to a desire to undo mastery through other kinds of mastery. So an example would be that for Gandhi, he would say, in order to remove our masters or to make our masters no longer masterful, we need to claim mastery over ourselves. And he meant literally over our individual bodies and our minds. And for someone like Fanon, he would say, mastery is so ingrained in who we understand ourselves to be, meaning if we're a colonized people, we understand ourselves fundamentally as dehuman, unhuman, and dehumanized. And so he believed that there needed to be a violent revolution, that those who were living under colonial rule needed to literally break down the systems of oppression that were governing over them, that were dehumanizing them. But he also believed in this kind of temporal moment of mastery, where this mastering of the master, if you will, would elevate the colonized people to being what he called man, to elevate them to the proper status of humankind. and to therefore give way to more equitable futures. So all of them in different ways were preoccupied with mastery, wanting to undo mastery, but really interestingly also continuously returning to other kinds of mastery to undo it. And that's really what I was trying to think about in the book, and to think about the ways in which our current political struggles continue to be formed and informed by new kinds or newfangled forms of mastery.
Well, let's speak to Marx. Marx clearly wanted to see the creation of a classless society, but he calls for a dictatorship in the interim of the proletariat. Does that not connote mastery?
Yes, certainly it does. And, you know, one of the things that I rely on thinkers like Marx and on thinkers like Gandhi and Fanon, while also staging what I call an indebted critique of them, which is to say, I don't believe that any of the political philosophies that have come before us have a wholesale solution to the contemporary moment. And I believe that when you look back at those theories and philosophies and activisms that we can see throughout modernity, what we can see is a whole series of slippages. And we live at a moment where we're willing to say, oh, you see a flaw in Marx? Then let's throw Marx out. Or, oh, you see a flaw in Gandhi? Let's throw Gandhi out. For instance, I was at a conference speaking to graduate students last year, and I was speaking about Gandhi, and some of the feminist graduate students in the room said, I'm totally uninterested in speaking about Gandhi. He was misogynist. I won't even bring up his name. And so it's a fire and brimstone kind of moment in which we can't even borrow from thinkers who had problematic politics in some ways, or who resuscitated or relied on forms of mastery in their thinking. And I'm invested in indebted critique and looking back at those thinkers who may very well have advocated for forms of violence or for forms of mastery that I don't agree with, but whose thinking nevertheless remains crucial to the building of my own.
I think that's part of my confusion with the book may be rooted in language. We inherit our language, of course, from the previous society, the previous regime. And when we revolt against that regime, we are using its language, the one we grew up with.
Yeah, in fact, the second chapter of my book is all about language and the ways in which during the last century, during all of these decolonization movements, language was one of the central preoccupations of how to stage a new society, how to create a new independent collective. And as you know, Glenn, during moments of decolonization, because nation states were essentially formed through an inorganic pushing together of a whole series of cultures and linguistic groups and traditions, there was no obvious way to gather a people through language. And I'm a comparative literature scholar, so language is at the heart of what I do. But one of the major critical debates in decolonization movements has always been the question of language. Do we throw out the question, the language of our masters? Do we choose one dominant language from among a very vast disparate linguistic population? How do we move toward new societies through the amalgamations of language?
You dedicate a lot of attention to Frantz Fanon. He's known as believing that the colonized man and woman becomes transformed by waging armed struggle against the colonizer. Armed struggle, which is brutal and aims at achieving mastery over the battlefield, whatever that battlefield is.
Yeah, and Fanon is really interesting as a political thinker because he believes in violent armed struggle and violent revolution and literally tearing down the structures of oppression that surround colonized people, but only in a temporal moment, right? So Fanon gets too quickly rehearsed as somebody who is committed to, wedded to violence, and indeed he is through the moment, the temporal moment of decolonization, but he imagines this moment of decolonization and of armed struggle and of violent revolution and indeed of mastery, mastering one's master, in order to pave the way for more equitable futures. And if you read his pose carefully, if you read his literature, he very often returns to this utopian idea of love among all men. So there's something very interesting in Sanal about the ways that he thinks violence and love together in a way that allows one to produce the other, which seems paradoxical, but of course is central to his political thinking.
So you seem to have given the okay to Frantz Fanon and to Marx. Who among actual revolutionaries or people who purport to be revolutionaries have succumbed to the master's kind of mastery?
Well, I think we don't need to look very far in the contemporary United States to see that. And I should say, I don't think that I'm giving anybody a thumbs up or a thumbs down. What I'm trying to do is a kind of more nuanced analysis of how anti-colonial leaders like Gandhi and like Fanon had slippages in their own thought or had ways of thinking masterfully that are neither positive nor negative to me, but deeply embedded in the ways that we mobilize today.
Yes, and describe some of those ways in which it's embedded.
Yeah, one of the potentially strange things that I do in Unthinking Mastery is it's a book that is written to an academic audience that attempts to ask them to think about the forms of mastery that they have remained wedded to in the production of academic, of intellectual thought. And so one of the sort of strange things that I end up doing in this book is to turn back to myself in very intimate and mundane ways. So I look at, for instance, my own upbringing or my relation of cohabitating with an animal over the course of two decades to think about the ways that practices of mastery are embedded in our everyday lives. So let me first speak about academia. One of the ways this project kind of came to rise is that I was reading all of this anti-colonial work and thinking very seriously about the kinds of questions that you're asking about how do we think about producing political resistance today without succumbing to a reproduction of the kind of mastery that we're trying to undo. I was at a conference and what I saw was a series of leaders in the field of comparative literature, so people thinking very carefully about international global languages and global literatures, who kept professing that what we needed professionally was to become better masters. We needed more mastery over our field, more linguistic mastery, more intellectual mastery. And what I was trying to think about was the ways that our education, our political education, those of us invested in decolonization and post-colonial and anti-colonial movements, were reading literature that continuously asked us to think against mastery at the same time as intellectually we kept thinking that we needed to be better and better and better masters of what we were doing. And so professionally, at the level of my career, I started thinking against mastery very actively, but that also seeped into the ways that we think about ourselves as subjects. And someone like Fred Moten, who would call for a consent to think beyond being a singular being, that singular being that Moten is talking about is a masterful subject that's born out of thinkers like John Locke, who understand man, capital M, A-N, man, as a subject who is inherently a master over himself. And I'm using gendered language intentionally here. And a lot of the kind of currents in decolonial thinking right now are trying to think against that production of man and the way that we've been raised to understand ourselves as fully in control of how we feel and fully in control of our bodies and fully in control of everything we do, instead of thinking about ourselves in dynamic relation to other people and deeply affected by the things that are happening and circulating around us. And that might be at the level even of the environment and the ways that our bodies are taking in contagions, or the ways that affect the way that you feel, Glenn, might very much permeate the way that I feel. And so against a kind of long training in whether or not you've been through academia, a long training just as people in this world, in this society that we've grown up in, understanding ourselves as masters over ourselves, they think that idea needs to be very much undone.
And how can your book be useful to people who think their life's work is making revolution against an oppressor anywhere in the world?
I think that the thing that my book is really trying to think about is the ways that all of us who are trying to produce resistance or who are trying to involve ourselves in revolution are also ensnared in forms of violence that we can't necessarily see. And one of the things that is interesting as a teacher in university today is a desire for a kind of generation of activists and young people who are amazing and inspired, but who also often don't think dynamically about what they're doing at the level of a kind of self-critique. And what I mean by that is, history always allows us to say, I can look back on Gandhi and Marx and Fanon and say, hey, those guys forgot about this or couldn't think about this. And we don't often think about what we can't think about in the current moment, which is to say, we may not be able to, in the here and now, diagnose the groups or the populations or the entities that we're not advocating for. A lot of us are trying to think intersectionally in a kind of revolutionary way that brings into conversation class and race and gender and sexuality, all of those categories, and to think about them as enmeshed and intermingled. And yet, even while we're trying to be intersectional, even while we're trying to be in kind of wide embrace of so many forms of oppression and exclusion, we forget or we elide other groups and populations that we're not advocating for. And so I think that if anything, the book is really trying to make us more sensitive to the things that we can't yet think or the ways that we're not yet in embrace of certain populations or certain entities who are not being supported by our movement.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.